since he was enslaved to his desire for her, and allowed her to reign and rule over him, without reckoning this into account for the times, she often treated him insolently. And this he bore with self-control and even generosity, pretending not to notice. But openly she mocked her mother-in-law and sister-in-law for their low birth and spoke ill of them, so that there was already faction and irreconcilable hatred among the women, and at that time even greater slanders. The suspicion, nursed along, lasted the length of a year from the time Herod returned from Caesar. But what had long been brewing finally broke out from the following occasion. The king lay down to rest at midday, and out of the affection he always felt for her, summoned Mariam. She came in, but did not lie down with him. Instead, she scorned him, and as he pressed her, reviled him further, saying that he had killed her father and her brother. He bore this insult badly, and was on the verge of some rash act, when Salome, the king's sister, noticing his deepening agitation, sent in the cupbearer, who had long been prepared for this, instructing him to say that Mariam had persuaded him to prepare a love potion for her to use on the king. If the king grew alarmed and asked what this meant, he was to say that she had a drug which she had urged him to administer, and that if he showed no interest in the love potion, he should let the matter drop, since it posed no danger to him. Having coached him in this, she sent him in at that very moment to speak with the king. He came in persuasively, and with apparent urgency, saying that Mariam had given him gifts and was trying to persuade him to give the king a love potion. When Herod was disturbed by this and asked what the potion was, he said it was a drug given him by her, whose power he himself did not know, and that for this reason he thought it safer to report it, both for his own sake and the king's. Hearing such words, Herod, already ill-disposed toward her, grew still more provoked, and had the eunuch, who was most trusted by Mariam, tortured concerning the drug, knowing that nothing, great or small, could be done without his knowledge. The man, under duress, had nothing to say of the matter for which he was tortured, but he did say that the woman's hatred toward the king had arisen because of things Soemus had told her. While he was still speaking this, the king cried out loudly that Soemus, who had been most loyal to him and his kingdom in every other respect, would never have betrayed his orders unless he had also gone further into intimacy with Mariam. He at once ordered Soemus seized and put to death. As for his wife, he handed the judgment over to a court, gathering his closest associates and pressing the accusation with great vehemence concerning the alleged love potions and drugs. He was unrestrained in his speech and more prone to anger than to fair judgment, and in the end, seeing him in this state, those present condemned her to death. Once the verdict was passed, some such thought also arose in him, and in some of those present, that she should not be put to death so precipitately, but rather confined in one of the kingdom's fortresses. But Salome's faction pressed hard to have the woman put out of the way, and persuaded the king, warning him to guard against the disturbances of the populace should she happen to remain alive. And so Mariam was led away to her death. Alexandra, observing the moment, and realizing that she had little hope of escaping a similar fate at Herod's hands, changed her attitude in a manner utterly contrary to her earlier boldness, and quite unbecoming. Wishing to make clear her ignorance of the charges her daughter faced, she rushed forward, and, reviling her own daughter in front of everyone, cried out that she had been wicked and ungrateful to her husband, and deserved to suffer such things for having dared to do them, for she had not repaid as she ought the benefactor of them all. While she was play-acting in this shameless way, even daring to lay hold of her daughter's hair, there was, as one would expect, much condemnation from the onlookers of her unseemly pretense. But it showed itself even more clearly in the woman about to die herself. For Mariam neither answered a word from the start nor, disturbed by her mother's ill grace, so much as glanced at her, but by her bearing made plain that she was troubled far more by her mother's shamelessly displayed misconduct than by her own peril. She herself went to her death with unshaken composure and unchanged color, revealing her nobility to those watching even in her final moments. And so she died, a woman outstanding both in self-mastery and in greatness of spirit. But she lacked fair-mindedness, and there was more of a contentious streak in her nature. In beauty of body and in the dignity of her bearing and company, she surpassed the women of her time by far, and this gave her the greater occasion for failing to live so as to please the king or for her own pleasure. For, being courted because of his love, and expecting nothing untoward from him, she indulged in an unmeasured freedom of speech. She was also vexed on account of her own family, and thought it right to tell Herod everything she had suffered. And in the end, she succeeded in making his mother and sister her enemies, and even the king himself, the one man on whom alone she had relied not to suffer anything unpleasant. Once she was put to death, the king's desire for her only blazed up the more, he being disposed as we described earlier. For the love he had for her was not the ordinary sort born of familiarity, but had begun from the first as something like frenzy, and had not been overcome by the license of their life together into growing any less. Then indeed it seemed, as if in some vengeance for Mariam's destruction, to fasten upon him all the more. He often called out for her, and often gave way to unseemly lamentation, and devised everything he could to distract himself, arranging drinking parties and gatherings, but none of it was enough. He therefore neglected the administration of the kingdom's affairs, and was so overcome by his passion that he actually ordered his servants to summon Mariam, as though she were still alive and able to answer. While he was in this state, a plague broke out, which destroyed most of the common people and the most honored of his friends, and gave everyone occasion to suspect that this had come about through divine wrath for the lawless act committed against Mariam. This too weighed further upon the king, and in the end, giving himself over to the wilderness, and under pretext of hunting parties wandering there in his distress, he did not last many days before falling into a most severe illness. An inflammation, together with a pain at the back of the head, and a derangement of the mind. None of the treatments applied did any good, but rather, working against him, brought him near despair. All the physicians who attended him, since none of the remedies they administered had any effect on the disease, and since the king could do nothing but follow whatever his illness compelled, allowed him whatever he demanded, entrusting to fortune the slim hope of recovery that lay in his choice of regimen. And so he was nursed in this fashion in Samaria, which had been renamed Sebaste. Meanwhile, Alexandra, residing in Jerusalem and learning of his condition, was eager to gain control of the fortresses around the city. There were two of them, one belonging to the city itself, the other to the temple, and whoever held these had the whole nation in their power. For the sacrifices could not be performed without them, and no Jew could be brought to give up performing these more readily than to give up life itself, or the worship they were accustomed to render to God. Alexandra therefore made her approach to those in command of these garrisons, arguing that it was proper for them to hand over control to her and to Herod's children, so that no one else might seize power before someone else forestalled it, in the event of his death. For should he recover, no one would guard the interests of his family more securely than his own closest kin. They did not take her words kindly, being loyal men, and having been so throughout the earlier period, they remained all the more so at that time, both out of hatred for Alexandra, and because they considered it not even lawful to give up on Herod while he still lived. For they had long been his friends, one of them being even the king's own cousin, Achabus. They therefore sent at once and reported Alexandra's design to him. He, without any delay, ordered her put to death. But he himself, having barely and with great suffering survived his illness, was harsh in spirit and body alike, worn down as he was, prone to displeasure, and ready on every pretext to inflict punishment on those who fell into his hands. He put to death even his closest friends, Costobarus and Lysimachus, and the man called Antipater of Gadara, and also Dositheus, for the following reason. Costobarus was by birth an Idumean, of the first rank among his people, whose ancestors had served as priests of Cos, a god the Idumeans worship. When Hyrcanus had converted their political constitution to Jewish customs and laws, Herod, upon taking over the kingdom, appointed Costobarus governor of Idumea and Gaza, and gave him his sister Salome in marriage, having put to death Joseph, who had previously married her, as we have related. Costobarus, having gained this good fortune gladly and beyond his expectation, was carried away by his success and gradually overstepped his bounds, thinking it neither honorable for himself to obey Herod's commands as his ruler, nor right that the Idumeans, who had adopted Jewish customs, should remain subject to the Jews. He therefore sent word to Cleopatra of Idumea, claiming that he had always been descended from her ancestors, and that it was therefore just for him to ask Antony for the territory, for he himself was ready to transfer his loyalty to her. He did this not out of any greater regard for Cleopatra's rule, but because, if Herod were stripped of the greater part of his kingdom, he thought it would then be easy for him to rule over the Idumean nation on his own account and to achieve even greater things. For his ambitions ranged far, having no small resources of birth and of wealth, which he had amassed through continual dishonest gain, and he contemplated nothing modest. Cleopatra, however, having asked Antony for this territory, failed to obtain it. Word of these dealings reached Herod, and though he was ready to put Costobarus to death, still, at the entreaty of his sister and his mother, he let him go and thought him worthy of pardon, though he did not thereafter regard him as free of suspicion for what he had attempted at that time. Some time later it happened that Salome quarreled with Costobarus, and she at once sent him a bill of divorce, dissolving the marriage, though this was not in accordance with Jewish law. Among us it is permitted for a man to do this, but a woman may not, even once separated from her husband, marry another on her own authority unless her former husband consents. Salome, however, chose not the law of her own people but the law that came from power. She renounced the marriage on her own initiative and told her brother Herod that she was leaving her husband out of goodwill toward him, since she had learned that Costobarus, together with Antipater, Lysimachus, and Dositheus, was aiming at revolution. As proof of her word, she offered the sons of Saba, who, she said, had been kept alive by him for the past 12 years already. This was in fact true, and it struck the king with great astonishment, coming as it did against all expectation. He was all the more disturbed by the strangeness of the report. The case of the sons of Saba was one he had earlier been eager to pursue, treating them as enemies by disposition, but by then, through the long passage of time, it had faded even from memory. The hostility and hatred toward them had arisen in the following way. While Antigonus held the kingship, Herod was besieging the city of Jerusalem with his forces, and under the pressure of the hardships that beset those under siege, more and more of the besieged were calling for Herod and inclining their hopes toward him. But the sons of Saba, men of standing and influence with the populace, remained loyal to Antigonus throughout, continually slandering Herod and urging that the kingship be kept, in accordance with descent, for the ruling family. This was the policy they pursued, believing at the same time that it served their own advantage. When the city was captured, and Herod had gained control of affairs, Costobarus, who had been appointed to block the exits and guard the city so that none of the citizens who owed debts or who worked against the king's interests might slip away, and who knew that the sons of Saba were held in high regard and honor by the whole populace, judged that their preservation would count for much toward him in the event of a change of fortune. He therefore hid them away and concealed them on his own estates. For the time being, he satisfied Herod, since a suspicion of the truth had gotten about, by swearing an oath that he knew nothing of their whereabouts, and was thereby cleared of suspicion. But afterward, when the king issued proclamations and offered rewards for information and devised every means of search, Costobarus still did not come to confess. But having once denied it, he was convinced that being caught with the men discovered would cost him no less than it already had. And so, out of both goodwill and now necessity, he persisted in keeping them hidden. When word of this was brought to the king through his sister, he sent men to the places where they were reported to be staying and put both them and their accomplices to death, so that nothing was left of Hyrcanus's kindred, and the kingship became wholly his own, with no man of standing left to stand in the way of his lawless acts. For this reason, he departed still further from the customs of his ancestors, and through foreign practices, he undermined the ancient order of things, which had until then remained untouched, and from this, we have suffered no small harm even down to our own time, through the neglect of all that had formerly led the people toward piety. First of all, he established a contest of athletic games held every 5 years in honor of Caesar, and he built a theater in Jerusalem, and after that a very great amphitheater on the plain, both magnificent in their expense but foreign to Jewish custom, since the use and display of such spectacles is not part of our tradition. He nevertheless made the celebration of this 5-yearly festival most splendid, announcing it to the surrounding nations and summoning participants from every people. Athletes and the rest of the competitors were called from every land, drawn by hope of the prizes offered and by the glory of victory, and the foremost men in every discipline gathered there. For he offered the greatest of prizes not only to those who trained in gymnastic contests, but also to those engaged in music and to the so-called performers on the stage. And great pains were taken that all the most distinguished men should come to compete. He also offered no small rewards for 4-horse chariots, 2-horse chariots, and single riders, and he imitated everything that anywhere was pursued with lavish expense or solemn splendor, out of rivalry, to make the display renowned for himself. The theater itself was ringed about with inscriptions concerning Caesar, and with trophies of the nations he had won in war, all of them made of refined gold and silver for him. And as for the equipment used, there was nothing so costly, whether of clothing or of jeweled ornament, that was not put on display together with the contests to be seen. Provision was also made for wild beasts. A great many lions were gathered for him, along with other animals of exceptional strength or of a rarer kind, and combats were arranged between the beasts themselves and against condemned men thrown to fight them. To foreigners, this was at once astonishing for its expense and a source of thrilling entertainment in the dangers of the spectacle. But to the people of the land, it was a plain overthrow of the customs they held in honor. It appeared, from the outset, an act of impiety to throw men to wild beasts for the pleasure of an audience of men, and no less impious to exchange their ancestral customs for foreign practices. But what grieved them more than anything were the trophies, believing that these were images encased in armor. Since it was not their ancestral custom to venerate such things, they were greatly displeased. Nor did their agitation escape Herod's notice. He thought it untimely to use force, and so he tried, in private conversation, to soothe some of them and free them from their superstitious fear. He did not, however, persuade them. Instead, out of resentment at what they thought he was doing wrong, they cried out with one voice that even if everything else might be tolerable, they could not endure images of men set up in the city, meaning the trophies, for that, they said, was not their ancestral custom. Herod, seeing them so disturbed and unlikely to be easily won over unless given some reassurance, summoned the most eminent among them, brought them into the theater, and, pointing to the trophies, asked what exactly they supposed these things to be. When they cried out, "Images of men," he ordered the outer trappings stripped away and showed them the bare wood beneath. As soon as they were stripped of their coverings, the objects became a source of laughter, and this did much to dissolve the derision the people had already directed, even before this, at the manufacture of such statues. Having in this way outmaneuvered the crowd and dissolved the impulse of anger they had felt, most of them changed their minds and were no longer indignant. But some persisted in their resentment of these practices so foreign to custom, and, holding that the overthrow of ancestral traditions was the beginning of great evils, they judged it a righteous risk to run rather than seem to look on passively while Herod, altering their way of life by force, introduced customs foreign to it. A man who was king in name, but who, in fact, showed himself an enemy of the whole nation. As a result, 10 citizens bound themselves by oath to undertake every risk, hiding daggers under their cloaks. Among their number, sworn along with them, was a blind man who had joined out of indignation at what he had heard done and at his own loss of sight. Not that he was capable of any active part in carrying out the attempt, but he placed himself in readiness to suffer whatever befell the others, so that his presence might make the impulse of the conspirators no less determined on his account. Once resolved on this, they went by a signal into the theater, hoping that Herod himself would not escape them if they fell on him unseen, and believing that even if they failed to reach him, they would kill many of those around him, and that this alone would be enough, even should they themselves die, to bring home to the king, and to that whole people the outrages they thought he was committing. They stood ready then, in such eagerness beforehand. But one of the men Herod had appointed to look into and report such matters had discovered the whole plot, and denounced it to the king just as he was about to enter the theater. Herod, thinking the report not implausible, bearing in mind the hatred he knew many bore him, as well as the disturbances that kept arising over each new measure, withdrew to the palace and summoned by name the men under suspicion. When his attendants fell upon them, they knew at once they could not escape, being caught in the act. But they adorned the necessary end of their fate by yielding nothing of their resolve. Without shame and without denying the deed, they displayed the daggers already seized from them, and declared that the conspiracy had been formed honorably and with piety, not for the sake of any gain or any private grievance, but above all for the sake of the common customs, which it was right for all either to preserve or to die for beforehand. Having thus spoken out boldly in defense of their undertaking, they were led away by the king's men who surrounded them, and after enduring every torment, they perished. Not long afterward, some men, out of hatred, seized the informer who had exposed them and not only killed him but cut him limb from limb and threw him to the dogs. Though many of the citizens witnessed what was done, no one denounced them, until Herod, making the investigation harsher and more relentless, had certain women put to torture, and they confessed what they had seen done. The men responsible for the act were punished, their entire households included, as Herod pursued their recklessness. But the persistence of this hostility and the unshakable loyalty to the laws that lay behind it made Herod uneasy unless he could secure his rule with complete safety. He therefore resolved to surround the populace from every side, so that no uprising, should any occur, could go undetected. To this end, the city itself was already fortified for him by the citadel in which he resided, and the temple by the strength of the fortress called Antonia, built by him nearby. As a third stronghold against the whole people, he conceived of Samaria, which he named Sebaste, believing that it would strengthen his hold over the country no less, since it lay a single day's journey from Jerusalem and would be useful and serviceable both to those in the city and to those in the countryside. For the whole nation, he also built a fortress at the place once called Strato's Tower, renamed Caesarea by him. And in the Great Plain, he set apart land for his elite cavalry and founded there a settlement called Gaba, and in Perea one called Epsibonitis. In these and other particular measures, he was constantly devising something further for his security, dividing the whole nation under garrisons, so that it might least of all fall into disorder through its own freedom of action. Disorders which even the smallest disturbance once begun, regularly gave rise to, and so that, should anyone stir up trouble, it would not escape notice, since men were always stationed nearby who could both perceive it and prevent it. At that time, having set his mind on fortifying Samaria, he made a practice of settling there many of those who had fought alongside him in his wars, as well as many of the neighboring peoples, both out of ambition to raise up something new, since the place had not previously been counted among the notable cities, and, still more, because his ambition here served his own security. He changed its name, calling it Sebaste, and he distributed the best of the surrounding land among the settlers, so that they might live in prosperity from the very outset. And he surrounded the city with a strong wall, using the steepness of the site to increase its defensive strength, and giving it a size not like its former one, but such that it fell short of none of the most celebrated cities, for its circuit measured 20 stadia. Within it, at its center, he laid out a sacred precinct of 3.5 stadia, adorned in every way, and in it, he raised a temple that in size and beauty rivaled the most celebrated of temples. And in its several parts, he adorned the city throughout, seeing to what was necessary for security by making it, through the strength of its enclosing walls, a fortress serving a greater purpose, while attending also to its outward beauty, since it suited his love of splendor and his wish to leave behind, for later times, monuments of his generosity. In this year, the 13th of Herod's reign, the greatest calamities befell the land, whether because God was angered or because the evil came about in the natural course of recurring cycles. First, there were unbroken droughts, so that the earth, being barren, produced nothing of what it should have. And then, as the people's way of life was disrupted by the shortage of grain, bodily illnesses set in, and a plague-like affliction took hold, the two evils continually feeding one another. For the lack of medical care and of food made the pestilential disease, once it had begun to rage, all the worse. And the destruction wrought among those perishing in this way stripped even the survivors of their courage, since they were unable to provide for their own wants through any care of their own. And with the year's crops destroyed, and whatever had earlier been stored away now used up, nothing was left to give ground for good hope, since the evil, as far as one could judge, was only intensifying, and not merely for that 1 year, so that they were left with nothing in reserve, and even the seed grain that had survived was lost, the earth failing to yield even a second time. Necessity forced many innovations to meet these needs. The king himself found his own resources no less strained, since he had been deprived of the revenues he drew from the land and had spent his money lavishly on the cities he was improving. There seemed nothing that could offer any relief, given how far the calamity had already taken hold, together with the hatred his subjects bore him, for ill fortune is always quick to find fault with those in power. In such circumstances, he considered how to meet the crisis. It was difficult, since even those nearby who had grain had none to sell, having suffered no less themselves, and money was lacking as well, even if it had been possible to acquire a little at the cost of much. Yet, judging it right in every way not to neglect the relief effort, he broke up the ornamentation kept in his own palace, made of silver and gold, sparing neither the fine workmanship of its craftsmanship nor whatever else was costly by art. He sent the proceeds to Egypt, since Petronius now held that province from Caesar. Petronius, with no small number of people having taken refuge with him for the same needs, being besides a personal friend of Herod's and wishing to see those under him preserved, gave Herod's men first right to export grain and assisted him in every way with the purchase and shipment, so that this relief effort proved to be either the greater part or the whole of what was accomplished. For Herod, once these supplies arrived, added to them his own personal attention, and thereby not only won over the minds of those who had before been ill-disposed toward him, but made the greatest display of his goodwill and care for his people. First of all, he assigned to as many as could manage it themselves the task of preparing their own food, and made a most exact distribution of the grain. Since many were unable, through old age or some other infirmity, to prepare their food for themselves, he took care of them too, setting up bakers and supplying them with bread ready-made. He also took care that they should not pass the winter in danger, now that a shortage of clothing had struck as well, since the flocks had perished and been entirely used up, so that there was no wool to be had nor any other material for covering. When he had procured this for them too, he turned to bestowing benefits on the neighboring cities, distributing seed to the people of Syria. This service proved no less useful to him than the grain, since his generosity was so well aimed at producing abundance that everyone had enough food. In sum, when the harvest showed itself over the land, he sent out to the country not less than 50,000 people whom he himself had fed and kept alive. And in this way, having restored his kingdom, afflicted as it was, with the utmost zeal and diligence, he relieved no less the surrounding peoples who were suffering the same hardships. For there was no one who came to him in need who went away without securing help suited to his situation. Indeed, peoples and cities, and such private individuals as found themselves in want because they had many dependents, took refuge with him and obtained what they asked, so that, by calculation, the total quantity of grain given to those outside his realm came to 10,000 cores, a core holding 10 Attic medimni, while that given within the kingdom itself came to about 80,000. This care of his and the timeliness of his generosity had such an effect, both among the Jews themselves and in reports spread among others, that the old hatred stirred up by his tampering with some of their customs was banished from his kingdom and from the whole nation, and in its place appeared, as a kind of exchange, the outstanding generosity he had shown in relieving the direst distress. He gained fame abroad as well, and it seems that the hardships that befell him proved, beyond expectation, of benefit to him. Having ravaged his kingdom, they did him no small service in the matter of his reputation. For by showing, against expectation, a magnanimous spirit in the midst of scarcity, he won over the multitude, so that they came to judge, as though from the beginning, not by the record of his past deeds, but by the care he had displayed in a time of need. Around that time, he also sent Caesar an auxiliary force of 500 picked men from his bodyguard, whom Aelius Gallus led to the Red Sea, and they proved useful to him in many things. Again, then, as his affairs prospered toward increase, he built a palace in the upper city, raising enormous halls and adorning them at very great expense with gold, stone, and paneling, so that each of them could hold great numbers of men reclining at table, and they were named according to their size. One was called Caesar's, the other Agrippa's. He also acquired a wife, moved by erotic desire, taking no account at all of what was fitting for a life lived for his own pleasure. The beginning of his marriages came about as follows. There was a certain Simon, a Jerusalemite, son of one Boethus of Alexandria, a priest of some standing among the notable men, who had a daughter reputed the most beautiful of the time. When talk of her arose among the people of Jerusalem, Herod at first was stirred merely by hearsay, but when he saw her and was struck by the girl's beauty, he disapproved altogether of resorting to the exercise of sheer power, suspecting, rightly, that this would be denounced as violence and tyranny, and thought it better to take the girl in marriage. Since Simon was of too modest a rank to become kin to him, yet too considerable to be despised, he pursued his desire by the more decent course, raising them both and making them more honored. At once, then, he removed Jesus son of Phiabi from the high priesthood and appointed Simon in his place of honor, and so contracted the alliance with him. When the marriage had been completed, he also built a fortress on the site where he had defeated the Jews when Antigonus held power after Herod had been driven from his rule. This fortress is about 60 stadia from Jerusalem. It is naturally strong and most suitable for construction, being a hill of fair height, artificially raised so as to be shaped like a breast, ringed about with round towers, and having a steep ascent built up with 200 polished steps. Within it are luxurious royal apartments, built for security as much as for splendor. Around the base of the hill are buildings well worth seeing, in particular for the conveyance of water, for the place itself had none, achieved only after long labor and great expense. The level ground roundabout is built up as a city no smaller than others, with the hill serving as its acropolis over the rest of the settlement. With everything having turned out as he had hoped, he had no fear whatsoever of disturbances within his own kingdom, having secured the obedience of his subjects on both counts, through fear, since he was implacable in inflicting punishment, and through care, since he was found magnanimous in reversals of fortune. He surrounded himself with external security as well, treating it, so to speak, as a fortification for his subjects. He dealt skillfully and kindly with cities and cultivated the favor of rulers by the opportunities he gave each of them for benefaction, making his gifts the greater, and having a nature magnanimous in a way well suited to kingship, so that everything of his kept increasing in every respect as his fortunes always advanced further. But because of his ambition in this regard, and the attentions he paid to Caesar and the most powerful of the Romans, he was compelled to depart from his own customs and to corrupt many of his people's laws, out of ambition founding cities and raising temples, not within the land of the Jews, for they would not have tolerated such things, since it is forbidden among us to honor images and figures shaped after the Greek fashion. But he built up the outlying country and the surrounding regions in this way. Excusing himself to the Jews on the ground that he did nothing of his own will, but by command and order, while to Caesar and the Romans he represented it as gratifying them to a degree that fell not short even of the honor due his own people's customs. In reality, however, he aimed at the whole of it, or rather was ambitious to leave behind greater monuments of his rule for posterity. Hence, he also busied himself with the repair of cities and made very great expenditures for this purpose. Noticing also a place by the sea most suitable for receiving a city, formerly called Strato's Tower, he set about it on a magnificent plan, raising every building not carelessly but out of white stone, and adorning it with the most costly palaces and civic residences. But the greatest and most laborious achievement was a harbor safe from storms, of a size to match the Piraeus, containing berths within it and secondary anchorages, and remarkable for its construction, since the site itself offered nothing suited to so great an undertaking. But it was completed by imported materials and vast expenditure. The city lies in Phoenicia, along the coastal route to Egypt, between Joppa and Dora, small towns on the shore that are hard to put in at because of the exposure to the southwest wind, which continually drags the sand from the sea onto the shore and does not allow landing, so that merchants are generally forced to ride at anchor offshore. Correcting this awkward feature of the place, he marked out the circuit of the harbor to the extent needed for great fleets to ride at anchor by the shore and let down enormous stones into the depth to 20 fathoms. Most of these were 50 feet in length, not less than 18 in width, and 9 in depth, some larger, some smaller. The foundation, so far as it went, was laid out to 200 feet against the sea. Half of this was set forward to break the waves, so that the surge, broken there, would be repelled. Hence it was called the breakwater. While the rest carried a stone wall broken by towers, the largest of which is named Drusian, a very fine structure indeed, taking its name from Drusus, Caesar's stepson, who died young. Continuous vaulted chambers had been built to receive sailors, and before them a broad landing quay ran round in a circle, crowning the whole harbor, a most pleasant place to walk for those who wished it. The entrance and the mouth of the harbor were made to face north, the clearest quarter of the winds. At the base of the whole enclosure, on the left as one sails in, stands a tower firmly founded to hold out for a long time, and on the right two great stones, larger than the tower on the other side, standing upright and joined together. Round about the harbor in a circle are continuous dwellings built of the smoothest stone, and in the middle a certain rise, on which stands a temple of Caesar, visible far out to those sailing in, containing a statue of Roma and one of Caesar. And the city itself is called Caesarea, having obtained the finest material and construction. The parts beneath the city, sewers and passages, involve no less labor than the buildings above. Some of these run at regular intervals to the harbor and the sea, while one runs crosswise and girds them all, so that rainwater and the refuse of the inhabitants are easily carried off together. And the sea, when it presses in from outside, flows through and washes out the whole city. He also built in it a theater, and behind the southern part of the harbor, an amphitheater capable of holding a great crowd of people, positioned conveniently to look out over the sea. The city was thus completed in 12 years, the king never flagging in the labor nor falling short in the expense. While engaged in such matters, and with Sebaste now already a city, he decided to send his sons Alexander and Aristobulus to Rome to meet with Caesar. When they arrived there, their lodging was the house of Pollio, a man among those most devoted to friendship with Herod, but they were also permitted to lodge among Caesar's own household. For Caesar received the boys with every kindness, and granted Herod the right to settle the kingdom on whichever of his sons he wished, and further gave him the territory of Trachonitis, Batania, and Oronitis, granting it for the following reason. A certain Zenodorus had leased the estate of Lysanias. Since the revenues did not suffice for him, he drew a larger income by keeping the brigands active in Trachonitis. For men living there by lawlessness plundered the territory of the Damascenes, and Zenodorus neither restrained them, but shared in the profits himself. The neighboring peoples, suffering badly, cried out against Varro, then governing the province, and asked that they be allowed to write to Caesar about Zenodorus's wrongdoing. When this was reported to him, Caesar wrote back ordering the brigands destroyed and assigned the territory to Herod, so that through his care the region around Trachonitis would no longer prove troublesome to its neighbors, for it was not easy to restrain men who had made brigandage a habit and had no other means of living. They had neither cities nor landed property, but hideouts underground and caves, and shared their existence with their flocks. They had also devised reservoirs of water and stores of food able to hold out for a very long time hidden from view. Their entrances were narrow, admitting only one person at a time, but the interior was worked out to an unbelievable size for spaciousness. The ground above their dwellings was not high, but level as it were with the plain. The rock throughout was hard and difficult to traverse, unless one used a path under guidance, for even the paths do not run straight but wind in many coils. Once these men were prevented from doing harm to their neighbors, brigandage turned against one another, so that no form of lawlessness was left untried among them. Having received this favor from Caesar, Herod entered the region, and, with knowledge of the paths to guide him, put a stop to the wrongdoers and provided the surrounding peoples with untroubled peace. Zenodorus, aggrieved first at the loss of his province, and still more out of envy that Herod had come into possession of the rule, went up to Rome to accuse him. But he returned having accomplished nothing. Agrippa was sent as Caesar's deputy over the provinces beyond the Ionian Sea, and Herod, meeting him wintering near Mytilene, for he was on the closest and most familiar terms of friendship with him, returned again to Judea. Some Gadarenes came before Agrippa to accuse Herod, and he, without even giving them a hearing, sent them back to the king in chains. The Arabs, too, who had long been ill-disposed toward Herod's rule, were now stirred up and attempted to raise trouble against him, on this occasion with a cause that seemed more plausible. Zenodorus, already despairing of his own position, had hastened to sell a part of his province, Oronitis, to them for 50 talents. Since this was included in Caesar's grant, they disputed it as unjustly taken from them, at times resorting to raids and attempts at force, at other times going to plead their case. They also won over to their side those soldiers who were poor and ill-disposed, men always full of expectation and inclined toward revolution, the very thing in which those who fare badly in life most delight. Herod, though he knew these things had long been in preparation, nevertheless, out of calculation rather than hostility, sought to calm the disturbances, thinking it wrong to give them any occasion. Now, when the 17th year of his reign had already come, Caesar arrived in Syria, and at that time most of the inhabitants of Gadara cried out against Herod, saying he was harsh in his exactions and tyrannical. They ventured this chiefly because Zenodorus was pressing the matter and slandering him, having sworn oaths that he would not give up until he had by every means both stripped Herod of his kingdom and added it to Caesar's administration. Persuaded by him, the Gadarenes made no small outcry, emboldened by the fact that even those handed over by Agrippa had not been punished, Herod having let them go and having done no wrong. For if anyone else seemed implacable toward his own household, he was magnanimous in pardoning wrongs committed by others. So when they accused him of outrages, plunder, and the destruction of temples, Herod, undisturbed, was ready to make his defense, and Caesar received him kindly, in no way altered in his goodwill by the disturbance of the crowd. On the first day, the arguments about these matters were presented, but on the following days, the hearing did not proceed further. For the people of Gadara, seeing which way Caesar and the council were leaning, and expecting as was likely, that they would be handed over to the king, and fearing torture, some cut their own throats that night, some threw themselves from heights, and others flung themselves into the river and perished by their own will. This was taken as an admission of their rashness and wrongdoing, and Caesar, without any further delay, cleared Herod of the charges. And on top of what had already happened, there came no small stroke of good fortune. Zenodorus, his spleen having ruptured and much blood draining away through his illness, died at Antioch in Syria. Caesar then gave Herod no small part of Zenodorus's former territory, the land lying between Trachonitis and Galilee-Olathe, Paneas, and the surrounding country. He attached it to the administration of Syria, instructing the governors to act in all matters in consultation with Herod. Altogether, Herod's good fortune reached such a height that, of the two men who then governed the vast Roman world, Caesar and, after him, Agrippa, Caesar valued no one above Herod except Agrippa, and Agrippa placed Herod first in his friendship after Caesar himself. Enjoying such standing, Herod asked Caesar to grant a tetrarchy to his brother Pheroras, assigning it out of his own kingdom an income of 100 talents, so that if anything happened to him, Pheroras's position would be secure and not fall under the control of Herod's own sons by his wife. When he had escorted Caesar to the coast on his departure, Herod on his return built for him a magnificent temple of white stone in the district of Zenodorus, near the place called Panium. There is a very beautiful cave in a mountain there, beneath which the ground falls away into a deep chasm, choked with still water of unfathomable depth, and above it rises an enormous mountain. Beneath the cave, the springs of the Jordan River break forth. Herod further adorned this already famous spot with the temple, which he dedicated to Caesar. At that time, he also remitted a third of the taxes to the people of his kingdom, ostensibly so they might recover from a bad harvest, but in fact chiefly to win back their goodwill, since they had grown hostile to him. For in carrying out such measures as his, since their religious observance was being disrupted and their customs overturned, they had taken it hard, and there was talk everywhere among the people, who were constantly stirred up and agitated. Herod, for his part, applied great vigilance against any such unrest, depriving people of opportunities for it, and requiring that they be constantly occupied with labor. No assembly of the townspeople was permitted, nor any association for walking together or shared meals. Everything was kept under watch. Those who were caught faced harsh punishments, and many, both openly and secretly, were taken away to the fortress of Hyrcania and there put to death. Both in the city and on the roads there were men keeping watch on those who gathered together. It is said that Herod himself did not neglect this business, but often disguised himself as an ordinary man and mixed among the crowds at night, testing what opinion they held of his rule. As for those who were altogether defiant and refused to accommodate themselves to his ways, he hunted them down by every means. But the rest of the populace he required to bind themselves by oath of loyalty, compelling them to swear that they would maintain their goodwill toward his rule. Most people yielded to what he demanded, out of servility or fear, but those who showed independence of spirit and resented being forced into it, he removed from his path by every means. He also tried to persuade the followers of Pollio the Pharisee and Samyas, and most of those who associated with them, to take the oath, but they neither agreed to it, nor were they punished as the other refusers were, since out of respect for Pollio they were spared. The Essenes, as we call them, were also excused from this obligation, a group that follows a way of life like that established among the Greeks by Pythagoras. I discuss these matters more fully elsewhere. But it is worth explaining why Herod honored the Essenes and held them in higher regard than their mortal station would suggest, for the account is not unsuitable to the character of this history and will also illustrate what opinion was held of them. There was a certain Essene named Manahem, renowned for the excellence of his character and way of life, and possessing foreknowledge of the future granted by God. This man, seeing Herod while he was still a boy attending his lessons, hailed him as king of the Jews. Herod, thinking the man either did not know him or was mocking him, reminded him that he was merely a private citizen. Manahem, smiling gently and striking him on the buttocks with his hand, said, "Nevertheless, you will be king, and you will bring your rule to a happy conclusion, for you have been found worthy by God. And remember the blows of Manahem, so that this too may serve you as a token of the reversals of fortune. For the best course of reasoning would be this: if you were to love justice and piety toward God and fairness toward your citizens, but I know well that you will not be such a man, knowing the whole of it. For in good fortune you will surpass nearly everyone and win eternal renown, but you will forget piety and justice. These things will not escape God's notice, and at the close of your life, his wrath will be remembered against you in requital for them." At the time, Herod paid hardly any attention to these words, having no hope of such things. But as he gradually rose, even to kingship, and prospered, in the greatness of his rule, he sent for Manahem and asked him how long he would reign. Manahem did not tell him the whole of it. But when Herod pressed him with his silence, asking only whether he would have 10 years of kingship, he added 20, and then 30, without ever fixing an outer limit to the term. Herod, satisfied even with this, dismissed Manahem with a warm handshake, and from then on continued to honor all the Essenes. Even though these matters may seem strange, I have thought it worthwhile to relate them to my readers and to make plain something about our own people, since many among them are held worthy of such gifts because of their virtue and their knowledge of divine things. It was then, in the 18th year of Herod's reign, after the events already related, that he undertook a work of no ordinary kind: to rebuild the temple of God at his own expense, making its precinct larger and raising it to a more fitting height, believing that this, more than anything he had done, would prove, as indeed it did, the most conspicuous of all his achievements and would suffice to secure him everlasting remembrance. Knowing that the people were not eager for this, and that it would not be easy given the scale of the undertaking, he thought it best to prepare them first with a speech before attempting the whole project, and so he called them together and spoke as follows: "Of the other things I have accomplished during my reign, fellow countrymen, I think it superfluous to speak, although they were carried out in such a way as to bring less adornment to me than security to you. For neither in the most difficult circumstances did I neglect what served your needs, nor in my building projects did I pursue my own advantage more than the freedom from harm of you all, so that, I believe, With God's favor, I have brought the Jewish nation to a greater degree of prosperity than it ever had before. As for the individual works carried out throughout the country, and the cities we have built there, and in the territories newly acquired, adding to the glory of our people with the finest embellishment, it seems needless to me to speak of them to those who already know. But the undertaking which I now propose to attempt, I will now declare to be the most pious and the finest achievement of our times. For this temple was built to the Most High God by our fathers after the return from Babylon, but it falls short by 60 cubits of the height that it ought to have by so much did that first temple, which Solomon built, exceed it. And let no one condemn our fathers for neglecting their piety, for it was not by any fault of theirs that the temple came to be smaller than that one. Rather, it was Cyrus and Darius the son of Hystaspes who set the measurements for the building, and our fathers, being subject to them and their descendants, and afterward to the Macedonians, had no opportunity to restore the original structure to its full former size. But now, since I rule by the will of God, and there is a long span of peace, and abundance of wealth and greatness of revenue, and what matters most friendship and goodwill from the Romans, who rule virtually the whole world, I will try to remedy what was neglected through the constraint and subjection of earlier times, and to render to God the complete piety owed in return for the kingship I have obtained. Thus Herod spoke, and his words, coming as they did unexpectedly, struck most of the people with astonishment. The incredible scale of the hope did not stir them to enthusiasm. Rather, they were anxious that he might tear down the whole structure and then be unable to bring the undertaking to completion. The risk seemed to them too great, and the scale of the enterprise too hard to carry out. Seeing them in this state of mind, the king reassured them, declaring that he would not tear down the temple until everything needed for its completion had been prepared. And having said this in advance, he did not break his word. He made ready 1,000 wagons to carry the stones, selected 10,000 of the most skilled workmen, and bought sacerdotal robes for 1,000 priests, training some of them as masons and others as carpenters. And only then, when everything had been zealously prepared for him, did he set to work on the construction. Having removed the old foundations and laid new ones in their place, he raised up a temple 100 cubits in length and 20 cubits in extra height, which sank over time as the foundations settled. And this we had determined to raise again in the days of Nero. The temple was built of white and massive stones, each about 25 cubits in length, 8 in height, and about 12 in width. The whole of it, like the royal portico as well, was lowest at either end and highest in the middle, so that it was visible from many stads away to those living in the countryside, and especially to those who lived opposite it or were approaching it. The doors at the entrance, together with their lintels, were of the same height as the temple itself, and were adorned with elaborate hangings, on which flowers were worked in purple, and pillars woven into the design. Above them, beneath the cornices, stretched a golden vine with clusters of grapes hanging down, a marvel both of its size and of its craftsmanship to all who saw it, given the costliness of the material used in its making. He also surrounded the whole temple with immense colonnades, proportioned to match it, and surpassing in expense all that had gone before, so that no one seems to have adorned the temple more magnificently. Both the temple and its colonnades stood within the wall, and the wall itself was a work of the greatest magnitude ever recorded among men. There was a rocky hill rising gently on the eastern side of the city up to its highest point. This hill our first King Solomon, with great forethought and immense labor, walled in around the summit, building the wall from below starting at its base, which a deep ravine surrounds, with towering stones bound together with lead, always taking in more of the interior space as the wall advanced deeper into the ravine, so that the size and height of the structure, built up as a square, became immeasurable, so much so that the sizes of the stones could be seen on the outer face, while on the inside they were secured with iron to hold the joints immovable for all time. When the construction had thus reached the summit of the hill, he leveled off its top and filled in the hollows around the wall, making the whole surface even and smooth. This entire enclosure had a circuit of 4 stads, each side measuring 1 stade in length. Within this, and close by the summit itself, another wall of stone ran around above, having on its eastern ridge, level with the outer wall, a double colonnade facing the doors of the temple, which stood in the middle. This colonnade many earlier kings had built. Around the whole sanctuary hung barbarian spoils taken in war, all of which King Herod dedicated, adding to them what he had also taken from the Arabians. On the north side stood a well-fortified, four-cornered citadel of exceptional strength. This the kings and high priests of the Hasmonean line, before Herod, had built and called Bares, since the priestly vestments were kept there, to be worn by the high priest only when he had to perform sacrifice. King Herod kept the vestments there in the same place, and after his death, they remained under Roman control until the time of Tiberius Caesar. Under Tiberius, Vitellius, governor of Syria, visited Jerusalem, and when the people received him most splendidly, wishing to repay their kindness, he wrote to Tiberius Caesar, since they had asked to have the sacred vestments placed under their own authority, and Tiberius granted it. And control of the vestments remained with the Jews until the death of King Agrippa. After him, Cassius Longinus, then governor of Syria, and Cuspius Fadus, procurator of Judea, ordered the Jews to deposit the vestments in the Antonia, since the Romans, they said, ought to have control of them, as they had before. The Jews therefore sent envoys to Claudius Caesar to plead the matter. When they had gone up to Rome, the younger King Agrippa, who happened to be in Rome, asked the emperor for the authority over the vestments and received it, the emperor instructing Vitellius, the governor of Syria, accordingly. Previously, the vestments had been kept under the seal of the high priest and the treasurers, and on the day before a festival, the treasurers would go up to the Roman garrison commander, examine their own seal, and take the vestments. Then again, once the festival had passed, they would bring them back to the same place, and after showing the commander the seal was intact, deposit them there once more. This was the situation, made clear by the misfortune of the events that followed. At that time, then, Herod, king of the Jews, made this citadel two more secure, for the safety and guarding of the temple, and named it Antonia, in honor of his friend Antony, ruler of the Romans. On the western side of the enclosure, there stood four gates, one leading to the royal palace, crossing the intervening ravine by a passage, two leading to the suburb, and the last leading to the rest of the city, reached by many steps down into the ravine and then up again from there to the ascent on the other side, for the city lay directly opposite the temple. On the western side of the enclosure stood four gates. One led to the palace, crossing the intervening ravine, two led to the suburb, and the last led to the rest of the city, by many steps down into the ravine and then up again on the other side to the ascent, for the city lay opposite the temple, shaped like a theater, hemmed in on its whole southern flank by a deep ravine. The fourth face of the enclosure, the one facing south, likewise had gates in its middle, and above them ran the royal portico, a triple colonnade stretching the full length from the eastern ravine to the western. It was impossible to extend it any farther, and it was the most remarkable work under the sun. For since the retaining wall of the ravine was enormous and unbearable to look down from, if one leaned over from above into the depth, the height of the portico built upon it rose to an equally immense scale, so that if someone standing at the top of its roof combined both depths in a single glance, dizziness would overcome him, his sight unable to reach the measureless bottom. Columns stood in rows opposite one another, four rows deep. The fourth row was bonded into a wall built of stone, and each column was thick enough that three men, arms outstretched, could just encircle it, and 27 feet tall, set on a double base. The columns numbered 162 in all, their capitals worked in the Corinthian style, carved with a workmanship that struck onlookers with amazement at the grandeur of the whole. With four rows of columns, three aisles were formed running the length between the colonnades. Of these, two were parallel and built in the same fashion, each 30 feet wide, a stadium long, and more than 50 feet high. The middle aisle was 1.5 times as wide and twice as high, rising far above the two on either side. The ceilings were adorned with wood carved in manifold patterns of figures, and the middle aisle's height was raised still further by a parapet wall built above the architraves, set with engaged columns, the whole of polished stone, a sight incredible to those who had not seen it, and one that struck all who beheld it with wonder. Such, then, was the first enclosure. Not far within it, and reached by a few steps, was a second court, surrounded by a stone balustrade with an inscription forbidding any foreigner to enter, on pain of death. This inner enclosure had, on its southern and northern sides, gateways in three rows set apart from one another, and on the side facing the sunrise, a single great gate, through which we who were richly pure passed together with our wives. Farther within, that same area was forbidden to women. Farther in still was a third court, which only the priests were permitted to enter. Within this stood the temple itself, and before it the altar on which we used to offer whole burnt sacrifices to God. Into none of these three courts did King Herod ever pass, for he was barred from doing so, not being a priest. But he did busy himself with the work on the porticos and the outer enclosures, and these he built in 8 years. When the temple itself had been built by the priests in 1 year and 5 months, the whole people was filled with joy, and, marveling at the speed of the work, they first gave thanks to God, and then celebrated with equal enthusiasm for the king, the rebuilding, praising it with acclamations. The king sacrificed 300 oxen to God, and the rest of the people offered as many as each could afford, a number impossible to state, for it truly defies telling. As it happened, the appointed date for finishing the work on the temple coincided with the day of the king's accession, which by custom they used to celebrate, so that the two feasts falling together made the occasion the most splendid of all. A secret tunnel was also built for the king, running from the Antonia to the inner sanctuary, to the eastern gate, above which he also built himself a tower, so that he might go up into it through the underground passage, guarding against any uprising of the people directed at the kings. It is said that at that time, while the temple was under construction, no rain fell during the day, but showers came only at night, so as not to hinder the work. And this account has been handed down to us by our fathers, nor is it hard to believe, if one considers the other manifestations of God as well. In this manner, then, the work on the temple was completed.